Tonight we're going to be considering the question of husband-wife communications. And what I want us to do is to look at the many general directions regarding speech and then apply these specifically to marriage. I think one of our problems is that we often agree with the Bible in general without practicing it in particular. In other words, isn't that a great idea? Yes, well, we agree with that. Now, let's try that in this situation and in this situation. So if you aren't married, you can apply it in other ways. You can apply it to a specific situation that fits your context. You can apply it to how you speak to your parents or to your grandparents or to somebody at your church or whatever. But tonight we're going to be focusing on husband-wife communications. So this is not going to be the usual, procedure, I suppose, of looking into the various psychological things about speech and how it affects people and all that. It's just simply going to be going through biblical texts. And let me say at the beginning, I'm not covering all the biblical texts. Hopefully, by covering some of them, then it'll whet your appetite for finding the rest. Colossians chapter 4, verse 6. General New Testament directions regarding speech. It says, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." Do you notice? Always with grace, seasoned with salt. And if you violate this, it will result in a lack of insight. In other words, you won't know how to answer each one. In fact, remember that Jesus told his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing, but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." You see, salt not only gives taste to food, but also acts as a preservative, preventing decay. And Christ's followers support what is good and oppose what is corrupt, all the while making what is good attractive to those who hear. And our speech is a vital part of that. So Paul commands us regarding speech, and he is alluding to Jesus' statement about salt. Our speech should always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so we may know how to answer every person. So can we say that our communication with our spouse meets that criterion? Can we say that yes, as we speak to our spouse, we are upholding the standard of Christ and opposing what is corrupt and making what is good attractive? You see, gracious speech with your spouse will increase your ability to answer with wisdom as you continue your discussion. It's no wonder that many times conversations between spouses spiral downhill into foolishness, because failure to speak with this kind of wisdom results in an inability to respond with wisdom as the discussion continues. Notice the connection between the two halves of that verse. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer every person. And so certainly, as you speak to your spouse, you should be meeting that criteria. Ephesians 4, verse 15 says we are to speak the truth in love. And the goal is so that we can grow up in Christ. And again, violating the first part, we miss out on the second part. Notice the pattern of life that's to be within the brotherhood there. Ephesians 4, 15. By always speaking the truth in love, we may mature in all aspects into Christ. And so, if you miss out on the first part of the verse, you're missing out on the second part of the verse, out of the mutual growth that God intends. And that's also true for the more intimate relationship that you have with your spouse. If you fail to admonish one another with the truth, or you fail to do it lovingly, it hinders the spiritual growth of both marriage partners. Ephesians 4, verses 25 to 32. It says, putting away lying. Who did Paul write that to? The government officers in Ottawa? No, he wrote that to the church. So, putting away lying, and it says, because you are what? Members one of another. Well, more than any other person in the fellowship, a husband and wife are members of each other. And then verses 26 and 27, don't harbor resentment. And then verse 29 and 32 to 32 there, edifying speech has these characteristics. You know, one of the major ways of grieving the Spirit is to be guilty of the kind of speech it talks about there in the last few verses of that chapter. And so Paul, did you notice Ephesians 4? He discusses proper speech before he discusses the authority structure in the home, that the wife is to be submissive to the husband. And some husbands focus on positional authority without having learned to communicate wisely and kindly inside that sphere of authority. You might like to turn to James chapter 3. James 3, verse 5. It says that the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body, and it sets on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Now notice, we tend to forget how dangerous an uncontrolled tongue is. It's as dangerous as fire. It's as deadly as poison. It's impossible for anyone to tame. Now, most married couples would be horrified at the idea of allowing a dangerous wild animal to run loose throughout their house. In fact, I was talking to a surgeon recently, and he was telling me about an experience he had about 30 years ago. He was bitten by a grizzly bear in Montana. And he said it bit him right here under the arm. And he said, you know, it's a lot worse than getting bitten by a dog. I mean, those grizzly bears bite hard, and it really hurts. Now, just imagine if you had a grizzly bear loose in your house. Would you tolerate that? The picture here is the tongue is as dangerous as fire, deadly as poison, impossible for anyone to tame. And you know, people wouldn't think of having an animal like that in the house running loose. But often in houses, there's the tongue running wild. You know, if you freely speak to your spouse with an uncontrolled tongue, it's more dangerous than the grizzly bear. I think so often we are concerned about physical dangers far more than spiritual dangers. Keep reading in the chapter if you glance down a little further. Verse 11. It's impossible for a spring to send forth fresh and bitter water from the same opening. Now, what does that mean? If there's some bitter water coming out, what does it mean? All of the water coming out of that same opening is bitter. It gets all mixed together. You see, any spring that is sending bitter water is a bitter spring. There's a bad character there. And you notice in James chapter 1, verse 26, it says, failure to control your tongue is evidence of worthless religion. Amazing. In fact, it says, if any man think he's religious and doesn't control his tongue, his religion is vain. In other words, it's very easy to think you're religious, and then you have this indicator that you aren't. Now, if that is the deal, no man can control the tongue, and if you don't control the tongue, it's proof your religion is junk. That's a pretty bad dilemma to be in, doesn't it? What's the answer to that? The only solution is resurrection life. Supernatural resurrection life. That's the only solution. And did you know that improper use of the tongue is probably one of the major sources of conflict and bitterness in marriages? Now let's turn to the book of Proverbs, and we'll look at a few passages here and see what we can learn about the tongue. And we're going to apply it now specifically, as we have been, to married couples. So glance at Proverbs 16 and glance at verses 16 through 30, and in particular 16 through 20. Just glance at that as I make a few comments to say that true wisdom is the foundation of proper use of the tongue. You see, in verse 16, wisdom is better than riches. And verse 17, clarity of direction comes from deliberately refusing evil. Verse 18, if you're a proud person, that pride will destroy you. And verse 19, humility is more valuable than advantage obtained through arrogance. And verse 20, whoever heeds these instructions will prosper and be blessed by trusting God. And now we think about that kind of basic foundation and we apply that to speech that we see in verses 21 to 24. Notice that those verses, verses 21 to 24, the wise in heart will be called prudent and sweetness of the lips increases learning. You see, a wise heart will be evidenced by proper speech. And it says sweetness increases learning. So what this means is if your spouse is a slow learner, you can increase the sweetness of your words. And that'll increase learning. You know what will happen when you speak to your spouse? The spouse will rehearse the words in her mind or his mind. And so make your words sweet enough that he will enjoy the rehearsal. I think about Ezekiel sometimes. You know, Ezekiel was a prophet that preached a message that people didn't want to hear, but he did it so well that people loved to just hear him talk. They said it's like somebody plays a beautiful song. So they didn't care about what he said. They didn't like what he said. They didn't believe what he said. They didn't want to obey what he said, but they liked to hear him preach. Isn't that amazing? Now, sometimes a spouse may have had an exasperating day. So they might not be in a frame of mind to receive correction on something just then. Verse 22, to offer correction at such a time is actually foolishness on your part. Verse 23, wisdom teaches the mouth. You know, too often we speak without applying our hearts to wisdom. Verse 24, pleasant words are like honeycomb to the hearer, sweetness to the soul and health to the inner being. One of the things you can do is look for things in your spouse that are commendable and verbalize those things to each other. I mean, do you notice what your spouse does that's a blessing to you? Do you express thanks for that? If you don't, start doing it, you see, because it will develop into a mutual expression. Because as one person hears those kinds of thanksgivings, it is natural to respond back. Verses 25 to 30. Here's some examples of folly in speech. You see, verse 25, there's a way that seems right to a man. It's so easy to just bluster along with your own ideas and not be listening to what the other person is saying. Verse 26, this false way is based on selfishness. It's fulfilling your own desires. Verse 27, if you are dealing with your spouse in a way that you're digging up some evil in the past, you are like a scorching fire. You know, if something has been taken care of, don't dig it up. Verse 28, if you belittle your spouse to the children, it's an example of sowing strife, which is a mark of perversity. In verse 29, enticing someone into what is not good, using words wrongly. That is very foolish speech. Now, one of the things that Proverbs teaches us is that we need to learn to restrain our lips. You might like to look at Proverbs 17, verse 27 and 28. It says, he who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is a calm spirit. Even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he is considered perceptive. I mean, God has said some strong things there about talking too much. Notice that If you look at chapter 10, verse 19, you find something else along those lines. It says, in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. In other words, it's sinful to talk too much. Now, why is that? The excessive talker views his opinions, his stories, his comments as much more valuable than anyone else. In other words, it's a measure of pride. You know, if I had just stood up here and said, I think people that talk too much are sinning, you would probably have objected, right? But when it says in the Bible, in the multitudes of words, sin is not lacking, that needs to sober us up, doesn't it? You know, that can be true with a spouse, too. James 1, verse 19 is a verse, it's in the New Testament again, but we should look at it a little bit. James 1, verse 19. And I'm sure some of you could quote that verse. It says, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Now, look at the connection between that and the next verse. I'm sorry. It's the next connection between 19 and 20. You see, swift to hear, slow to speak, knowing that human wrath does not produce God's righteousness. We've got to see the connection in the verse. You see, the Lord is known by what? The Lord is known by how slow to wrath he is. And it's very possible that immediate wrath is often the wrong kind. But often in moments of wrath, we are what? The opposite of this verse. We are slow to hear and swift to speak. Have you ever experienced that? And then what do? We say things we regret. Now, God has helped us out with an object lesson. The object lesson is everybody has one mouth and two ears. That suggests you should listen twice as much as you talk. That's object lesson number one. Object lesson number two, we have two gates. Okay, thanks. Object lesson number two is we have two gates to keep the tongue confined. The teeth and the lips. Now, isn't that interesting? That's an object lesson that is with you every day. I'd like for you to look for a moment at a man who couldn't control his tongue. Genesis chapter 31. We'll begin looking at verse 24. This is the account of where David had decided to leave and go home. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. Then he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey and overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. Verse 24. But God had come to Laban the Syrian at night in a dream and said to him, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Now think about that a minute. So what should Laban say when he meets Jacob? He can't say anything good. He can't say anything bad. That pretty well eliminates it, doesn't it? He should have turned around and go home. But he didn't. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs with timbrel and harp, and you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to harm you, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.
And now you have surely gone because you are greatly longed for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? Whew. Did Jacob misunderstand what God told him? I'm sorry. Did Laban misunderstand what God told him? No, he understood it. He even quoted it. You see, God knew that Laban couldn't be trusted. He was a corrupt person. He was a wicked man. He was a cheat. And even though he might think he was speaking something good, I mean, maybe he thought he was speaking to Jacob good stuff the whole time. I don't know. But that's how people are. If you're corrupt, your words are going to be corruption coming out. And see, God said to him, don't say good or bad. Why did he say that? Because he couldn't trust it to understand what good or bad was. And his heart was bad. Now, this corresponds precisely to James chapter 3, verse 8. A bad spring sends forth only bad water. Yesterday, when I was talking about Proverbs, I mentioned this whole thing of Proverbs and the contentious woman. So we might just glance at a couple of those. I didn't quote them very well last night. Proverbs 19:13. A foolish son is the ruin of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dripping. What's the worst thing that can happen to a father? Have a son who's a fool. What's the worst thing that can happen to a husband? Have a wife who's a drip. Contentious, drip, 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 drip. Chapter 27, verse 15. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. In other words, the pictures he give is that it's impossible to fix this. Chapter 21, verse 9. Better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And then it's like as if the writer didn't feel like that was strong enough. So in verse 19, he said, better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. So you see, here's some verses specifically in relation to the marriage relationship. Avoid the nagging contentiousness. Proverbs 15, verse 28. If you need to confront your spouse, study carefully before you do it. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil. You know, there are times that we need to share something with our spouse that will be maybe difficult for them to receive. But think about what you're saying and how you're going to say it before you say it. See, the righteous studies how to answer, wants to do this in the right kind of way, but the wicked just goes, pours it forth. Chapter 25, verse 11, amplifies this point. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver. In other words, if you're going to make a piece of art, you choose the position and the aspect and all these details very carefully to make it a very pleasing thing. And it says a word fitly spoken is like that. And so, if we're speaking to our spouse, and particularly about something that might be uncomfortable, we need to be thinking about how can we say this so it can be beautifully said. It's not just slapping together whatever comes to your mind, but thinking so you can share it beautifully. Proverbs 15, verses 1 to 4. This verse 1 is often quoted by itself. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. That's certainly a verse that's worth thinking deeply about. But actually, a fuller understanding comes by realizing that verses 1, 2, 3, and 4 form a paragraph. You see, a soft answer turns away wrath. If you don't have the soft answer, you will tend to have the second part, namely the wrath. And then verse 2 is still part of this discussion. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. You know, it's possible to have wisdom of certain facts, and you're able to debate maybe better than your spouse can. But if you can debate better than your spouse, and you use your knowledge of debate to make the spouse's ideas look silly, you are not using knowledge rightly. Because you're using knowledge to produce a wrong result. And that reminds me of something else. I think it's in Matthew 12. I can't remember for sure, but that verse occurs to me now. There's a verse where Jesus said, every idle word that men shall speak, they will have to give an account in the day of judgment. Now, I always grew up with the notion of thinking that would be like swear words and that kind of thing. Or maybe bywords. That's not the context at all. It's the context of using facts to help people come to a wrong conclusion. That's what the idle word is. You know, it's very possible to use truth and present it in a way to get people to believe something that's false. And that is the essence of Jesus' complaint about idle words. So if you are using facts and debating skill to produce a result that is not holy, in other words, that's not in conformity with God's truth, you will have to give account of that foolishness in the day of judgment. So when you're talking to your spouse, especially, you don't want to do that, because your spouse is your own flesh, your best friend. And so the goal is not winning the debate. The goal is coming to the truth. When we moved to North Carolina, our oldest daughter was about 19 years old. And she started to do some work at a local sewing shop where people made alterations in clothes and various things. And most of the ladies in this shop would have been in their 40s or 50s. Well, here's this young girl coming and working in the sewing shop. And of course, they would ask her questions about her life. And well, they found out that she was one of 8 children, or maybe she was talking to him when we had 9. I can't remember exactly how that was. But anyway, 8 or 9 children in the family, and our ways of doing things was very different from theirs. And so they'd ask her all kinds of questions. And one time they said to her, do your parents fight? And she said, no. Well, don't they ever disagree? How do they settle disagreements? And she said something that was an encouragement to me. She said, well, they just have a discussion. And then whoever is right, that's what they do. Now, that is what the goal is. The goal is seeking for truth. And so, if you don't agree, well, probably somebody's missing some truth somewhere if you don't agree. So the goal is to find out what the truth really is and go with that. You know, if you're really seeking for the truth, it's a great freeing thing, isn't it? And what did Jesus say? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And if the Son sets you free indeed, if the Son sets you free, you shall be free indeed. Back in chapter 15 of Proverbs, verse 3, still part of this same paragraph. The wise person remembers God is watching this very discussion, observing what is evil and good. So you're having a discussion with your spouse. And if you are manipulating that discussion to get your way, instead of really receive more of the truth, God is watching. Just remember that. Verse 4, a soothing tongue is like a tree of life. Unfairness breaks the spirit and ruins communication. You know, if you are unfair in the points that your spouse brings up and don't receive the intent of those points and recognize the validity of those points, what does that tell your spouse? It tells the spouse it is worthless to talk to you on that subject because you won't listen to the truth. You just want to create your own little thing. It is so important not to produce that kind of situation. Now remember, this isn't just a bunch of do's and don'ts. It's like, how do you want to live as a communicator with your spouse so that you can grow together in more and more truth and more delight and more fellowship? Isn't that what we all want? More and more of those things. And you know, we know things like, okay, if you have cattle and you feed them food that's mixed with sawdust and loco weed, something is going to go wrong. Don't we know that? Well, if you put stuff into your marriage that's bad, there'll be bad results. But if you follow these directions from the Bible, it can provide more and more good benefits. And you know, when you get in the habit of doing things right, right feels good, doesn't it? In fact, this is a little bit of an aside, but you know, one of the things that happens sometimes in homes is that children will begin to whine about stuff. They have a whiny attitude. And it sounds like this. You know, sort of that tone of voice. And it doesn't matter what the words are. It's just that whiny, wah, 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 that kind of sound. And you know, it's very easy for a wife to tune that out. But if you've worked hard to stop that kind of thing and make it unproductive for children, and the older ones learn that lesson, and some younger ones come along, and it seems like you don't have to teach them how to whine. They just know how. And they're doing that whining stuff. The older ones will say things like this. Make them stop it. I can't stand the sound of that. What's going on there? They've learned to feel and hear the niceness of proper kind of speech, and they don't like this other kind. You see, doing it right is normal. And so you want to do it right, normal, as spouses. Let's glance at chapter 12, verse 18. Proverbs 12, verse 18. There is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise promotes health. You see, you have one of those two options. You can speak to your spouse, and it's like, jabbing him with a sword, or you can actually promote health. And so you can make a decision. Which do you want to do? Do you want to do things that are as damaging as sword thrusts? Or like that surgeon said, you know, when grizzly bears bite, they bite hard. It really hurts. Or do you want to have the tongue of the wise, which brings healing? Proverbs 25, verse 15. By long forbearance, a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone. The particular last part there, if you think that your spouse is a little hard-headed, try this. Now let's think about, how can a gentle tongue break a bone? Well, have you ever been in a situation where you had a sledgehammer and you had a big ledge of rock that you needed to get rid of, and so you hit that rock, poing, and you hit it again, poing, and you hit it 10 times, poing, and then you hit the 11th time, poof. Have you ever felt that? Now, did that mean the first 10 whacks didn't do anything? No. They were doing something, you just couldn't see it. And finally, on that 11th whack, something happened. It collapsed. It fractured. So, I think that helps us see this picture. Even a most unlikely candidate, like a ruler, can be persuaded through long forbearance. A gentle tongue breaks a bone. Chapter 18. What we need to do is embrace wisdom in speech instead of folly. Notice verse 1. A man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all wise judgment. You know, one of the things that spouses do sometimes, they give the cold shoulder treatment. I'm just not going to talk to you. I have nothing to say. You know what that's doing? That's doing what it says there in verse 1. The person is isolating themselves. What for? What purpose? Because they're seeking their own desire. In other words, if I give you the cold shoulder long enough, you'll finally get so tired of it that you'll give in and I can have my way and then I'll talk to you again. That's really what it is. And that is a raging against all judgment. Verse 2. A fool does not want to learn, but only to express his own heart. You know, sometimes spouses do this to each other. Doesn't want to listen, just impose his own opinion on the companion. And he has no desire to be enlightened by what the spouse might say. It's like a great expression of folly. A closed mind and an open mouth. That's really dangerous, by the way. A closed mind and an open mouth. Verse 3. Failure to be obedient to God results in discussion laced with contempt instead of having an outflow of wisdom. Verse 4. And so, never show partiality to a view of your own that has elements of ungodliness. Verse 5a. It is not good to show partiality to the wicked. You see, if you have elements of ungodliness in what you're trying to promote, and then you're trying to say that and support that, you're showing partiality to an idea of your own that is wicked. Don't attempt to overthrow a statement by your spouse which you know is right, 5b, or overthrow the righteous in judgment. These are general statements about how we're to live. And so we need to apply these in relation to how we relate to our spouses. For example, in discussions regarding children, the goal must be non-partial evaluation of the situation. The goal is not to win your case. In fact, that's one of the reasons there's so much corruption in the United States legal system. Because the goal is not the truth. The goal is to win your case. And so if you can make the other, the opposition in the lawyer case, if you can make the opposition look like their position is ridiculous and that it is full of lies and all that, even though you know it's the truth, well then maybe you can win your case. And those kind of things are done. It's a very corrupting process. And you know, if you are trying to win your case against your spouse by using words in a certain way, you might win your case, but you're losing far more than you're winning. Because the goal must always be the seeking of the truth. Verses 6 and 7. When speaking to your spouse, make sure you are not acting like a fool. Do your words breed contention and call for fights? You know, there's some words that just raises the hackles up on people and makes them feel like fighting. Isn't that true? Well, you can use those when you speak to your spouse, or you can choose not to use them. Does what you say, verses 6 and 7, bring destruction and a trap from which there seems no escape? Well, what you need to do is repent of your folly, of taking your own way, and obey God, so there can be fellowship with your spouse instead of descending into a downhill spiral. Verses 13 through 17 is a little paragraph, and the focus is on a court case, but the principles of a court case apply also to a discussion between a husband and wife where there might be a point of disagreement. You see, in verse 13, it's shameful to answer too soon. I mean, if somebody answers before he's heard the case fully, it's folly and a shame to him. That's true with your spouse too. Maybe your spouse says, you know, here's the situation. And before she's finished speaking, you lip right in, yes, but I know what the answer is. That's folly. In fact, verse 14, the victim who is treated unfairly will begin to have a feeling of hopelessness when they're discussing with you. You know, for convenience sake, I think I'm going to say you talking to the men, and then spouse is only to say wife, and you wives can turn it around the other way. I'm just so tired of trying to say your spouse and the other one and all that kind of thing. But you understand what I'm doing here? We're just going to speak to the men and say they better treat their wife right, and you ought to be able to figure out that, yes, you ladies should treat your husband right. So we'll just go from there. You see, the contrast is verse 15. The prudent person seeks to know all the details of the case. So if you're speaking to your wife, you want to know all the details of what she's trying to present so you can evaluate that case more carefully and wisely and add wisdom to the situation. Verse 17. It is very easy to think that all your own ideas are wonderful. I mean, we're naturally inclined to do that. I like my ideas. Do you like your ideas? You better like them. If you don't like them, get rid of the ones you don't like and start getting some good ones. So we all like our ideas. And we think they're wonderful. And notice in verse 17, partial facts sound right at first. But sincerely invite your wife, who is your nearest and best neighbor, to scrutinize your ideas and hunt anything they can find is false. How would you like that? You want your wife hunting for things that are false in what you say? Well, it's an opportunity to get them fixed. I mean, it's a privilege to have your false ideas discarded. So, here's your nearest and best friend. Here's your closest neighbor. Let's get some benefit out of it. Verse 19, avoid offensive statements and actions, knowing that they will be very difficult to undo. A brother offended is harder to win than a strong city, and contentions are like the bars of a castle. So you see, that can apply to the husband-wife relationship. If you offend your wife, if you speak nastily to her, it will cut deep. And it's hard to undo what you've done. It says here, it's harder than to deal with a strong city, and contentions are like the bars of a castle. 1 minute of wrong speech can tear down what takes years to rebuild. And you can say, well, she should forgive. She should get over it. You shouldn't have caused it in the first place. Verse 20. Only say those things which you can be sure you will be pleased about later. A man's stomach shall be satisfied from the fruit of his mouth, from the produce of his lips he shall be filled. You know, the beginning of strife is like releasing water, so stop contention before it starts. That's Proverbs 17:14. You know, once water is released, you cannot easily put it back again. Chapter 20, verse 3, any fool can start a quarrel. But remember, right here in verse 21, the tongue has the power of death and life. And the spouse who loves to talk will eat the fruit of his own talking, whether it's good or bad. If you talk appropriately to your spouse, you'll reap that fruit. And if you talk in a wrong way toward your spouse, you'll reap that fruit. So determine before God to give life to your spouse. And notice the context of the next verse. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. I mean, certainly you do not want to mistreat this wonderful favor God has given to you. Verse 23. Avoid haughtiness, even if you can make a better case for your points in discussion than she can. Because in all of this, verse 24, you want your spouse to be your best friend. So, building channels of communication. Now, what I want you to see is we haven't covered all the verses in the Bible about speech, have we? So there's plenty more. You can look them up as an assignment. Apply all these verses specifically to your marriage and live an exemplary life without kindness and forgiveness. Ephesians 4:32. Even good words will be seen as phony. Serving one another. I believe many marriages could be improved if husbands and wives would treat each other as an honored guest. Just doing that. Things that they wouldn't think, you know, there'll be spouses who will do things to each other and say things to each other that they wouldn't think of doing that to an honored guest. In fact, most marriages would improve if there would be basically three things. One, confess all the wrongs that you've done in the past and ask forgiveness. And if it takes 3 days to cover them all, sit down and do it. And now, purpose that you will never bring those things up again, ever. That's done, finished. And then the second thing, or third thing, is treat each other as an honored guest. Don't worry about lots of other things, but just do that much. Many marriages would improve. Deal with selfishness in your own life. You know, if we want to be able to communicate with our spouse, we have to deal with selfishness. And I think that probably marriage is a place where it will reveal selfishness to you that you don't realize before you're married. It works like that. And so if you want to have good communication with your spouse, you're going to have to deal with selfishness. Avoid bad communication. We talked about cold shoulder. We talked about using logic and facts in a wrong way to make a false point appear true and a true point appear false. Often the cold shoulder treatment is a specific disobedience to Ephesians 4, 26 and 27, where a person is letting the sun go down on their wrath and giving place to the devil. And let me say this. We live in a culture that delights in negative humor toward the spouse. And I think it is very bad. It is very destructive. You can get cheap laughs by saying something that's negative humor toward your spouse. But you know what that negative humor is? It's an accumulating acid that weakens true fellowship. How about this one? My husband is an interior decorator. He strews his dirty socks all over the bedroom floor. Or they have guests come over for supper. And as they sit down to the meal, the husband says, "Well, I see we have burnt offerings tonight. That happens around here sometimes." And the guests chuckle. You know what really happened? She was frying the meat. The wife was frying the meat, and a child got his finger caught in the screen door. Now what's she going to say? "Just hold it there. Just hold it. Just let it bleed. I'm frying the meat. I got to get it just right because Daddy isn't going to like it if it's just scorched a teensy bit. Just hold it there. Hold it there. It's going to be another 2 minutes, but just hold it." Is that what she's going to do? No. She runs quick, grabs the screen door, tries to help the child, is managing that thing and comforting the child, and 10 minutes later she sees smoke just coming up out of that pan. There's no meat hardly. What do you want the wife to do? You see, that negative humor is cheap. In fact, one time we were on one of these trips and we were invited to someone's house for lunch. This man was a farmer, and so he was accustomed to coming home out of the fields for lunch at his house. And you know, sometimes you sit down at somebody's table and you can just look at the table and you can tell, now this is going to be a good meal. You ever had that experience? I've often had that experience. And so we're biting into this meal and it was very good. And then the husband said, "You really hit a lucky day today. You know, we don't usually have a lunch this fine." Oh. I didn't like it. But he didn't stop. He then bragged that his father used to say that about his mother, to his mother. And I thought it was so sad that here his wife had spent all this time making this beautiful meal for us, and so then he makes this snide remark about how, well, you know, she doesn't often fix a meal like this just for him. You know, you guys really hit it all fine. So when he got to talking about his dad and how he used to do, I said, "Well, did your mother like it?" "Well, he didn't think so." I said, "Do you think your wife likes it when you say it?" He didn't know. Or maybe I forget how it was. Maybe I told him to ask her. He asked her then and she said no. Well, I hoped it sank in deep. Some years later, we went back there again. And we had a wonderful meal. And he did not say a word about being lucky. You know, a reality check. If you think your spouse doesn't like it, don't do it. If you want to make negative humor, I tell you what you do. Make it about yourself. Be careful when you give the truth. It makes it easier to be accepted. Prepare by praying and thinking. Deal with what God speaks to you in your life. And then present it at the proper time in the proper way, like you would want to be treated. Be sure that when you have a discussion with your spouse, that you are fair in the discussion. If they make a valid point, and you understand the intent of the point, but they worded it in a way that technically it wasn't quite 100% correct, take their point. You remember in Thessalonians, it says, chapter 5, verse 19 to 22, and one of the things it says is, don't despise prophecies. Hold fast to what is good and do what? Discard what's not. Now, what if somebody would go to one of these stores along the highway and get you a wonderfully good, in America they call, in the United States they call them sub sandwiches. I don't know what they call them up here. Is that the same thing? Okay. You know, one of those that just looks so marvelously good. And so you take a big bite of that thing. Oh, it's delicious. And then you take another bite and, oh, there was a bunch of gravel in there. And so as gravel are clanking around in your teeth, and you say, mmm. And you, what do? Do you spit out the sandwich and clank those gravel in your teeth for the next hour? Or do you what? You spit the gravel out and look through the sandwich. Oh, there's no more gravel in here. I'll eat the part that's good. Maybe you throw the whole thing away, but you understand what I mean. So many people get a sandwich that has a few gravel in it, and instead of throwing away the gravel and eating the sandwich, they throw away the sandwich and eat the gravel. I mean, it's pitiful. So if your wife says something, and 90% of it is true, or maybe 50% of it's true, let's say, and half of it's gravel, throw away the gravel and keep the 50%. Don't just be clanking the gravel around in your teeth. You know, one of the things you can do is have lots of discussion with your spouse, with your wife, with your husband. I mean, have spiritual discussions. What do you think about this? What do you think about marriage and divorce? Not for yourselves, of course, but other people's discussions. You got to always make the context clear. How should the Christian properly use the Old Testament? You know, some people quote verses here and there. They'll say, this verse proves. And then there's another verse in the same chapter. They don't want to use that one. Which one do you use? Which one do you not? So a big discussion you could have with your wife on how should the Christian relate to the Old Testament? Or what does the book of Revelation mean? What should we learn from it? You know, we can sharpen one another with scriptures like iron against iron. And your spouse is your best friend, your closest companion. You can talk to her day and night. So start talking about the things of God. And have a sharpening of the minds spiritually. Also, for communications with your spouse, cultivate an interest in that your spouse enjoys. You know what's amazing to me? How many husbands don't pay any attention to having an interest in cooking? Husband, please, don't limit your wife to what your mother made. I mean, maybe she just made meat and potatoes. Well, that's good if you have meat and potatoes. That's great. But encourage her to use her creativity and branch out into other things. Try new recipes and improve them. And you can contribute yourself. Get a grill and prepare some of the stuff on the grill, especially in the summertime when it's hot, and have that heat outside. Encourage your wife's creativity. You know, we're always looking for new recipes. A great way to fix food. In fact, in our travels one time, we were at somebody's house and they served a casserole. egg casserole for breakfast. It was the best egg casserole I've ever eaten. It's called Gold Rush Casserole. And we eat it a lot of times at home. One time we served it to a missionary who came to our house. I imagine he'd eaten a lot of egg casseroles in his life. And, you know, some of them, do I dare say this, some of them have this sort of soggy bread in the bottom. They're not what you call impressive. Anyway, he took a couple bites and he said, "This is good." And it was so funny because I think he thought, well, this is just another egg casserole. But you see, it's like we get a recipe and we think, this has a lot of good ingredients in it. I wonder how we can improve this. So we have discussions about things like that. You know, soon after we were married, I was going to graduate school at the University of Virginia, and I was working on a PhD in mathematics. And when you study mathematics at that level, you encounter some very difficult problems. Algebra is just like the alphabet, and then calculus would be like maybe the forming of a few words, and then the real stuff is on top of that yet. Anyway, you end up having some very hard problems, and you're supposed to prove that if you have these conditions, then that'll give you this condition. And so I'd get stuck on some of these hard math problems. So I would come home and talk to my wife about it. Now, in order to talk to her about these hard math problems, I had to explain to her sort of what it was about. So, like for example, if I was going to talk about a certain problem in vector spaces, I had to explain what a vector space is and give her some examples of what a vector space is, and then talk to her about how vector spaces are linear and what that means, and now you have a distributive property and how that fits together. And then, so then once you have those kind of things, you can say that under certain conditions you have this condition, and then if you have this condition, that'll give you this condition, and I can get this far and this far and this far as I go down this proof, and I get stuck. And right there, I can't seem to make the bridge point to where I need to go. Oh, yes, I do see it after all. What happened? Because you see, in order to give her a basic idea of this complicated mathematical thing, I had to organize it in my mind to explain to her the basic details of it. And in the process of doing that, it clarified the material to me. And before I got done talking to her, I knew the answer. Now, what if she'd have said, "Ha, that math stuff, it's way over my head. I'll never understand it." You know what? We would have missed out on some communication, wouldn't we? And we would have missed out on some fellowship. Read books. Now, maybe one spouse is not a reader. Well, then that person ought to be a good listener. So read books aloud. And you know, in America, we spend lots of time in a vehicle. So get some good books. And read them as you drive. I mean, read them as the other person is driving. And or you can tell each other about books you're reading. You know, Rhoda and I tend to read somewhat different books. And so I'll ask her sometimes about what she's reading and what she's learning from those books. And I'll tell her about some of the things I'm learning from other books. Discuss ideas. One of the things we need to learn to do is speak the way God wants us to speak. You know, Jesus is such a marvelous example in this. John chapter 8, verse 28. Listen to it. Jesus said to them, "When you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am He and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father taught me, I speak these things." In other words, Jesus is saying, I don't say a single thing but what I hear my Father telling me what to say. And then in chapter 12 of John, verse 49, it says, "I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that His command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak." Jesus is saying, I don't speak anything but what I hear the Father say, and I say it exactly like He says it. You see, that is what we need to learn to do. Now, we need to learn to do that in general. When he wants us to speak, how he wants us to speak. But certainly, we need to learn to do it with our spouse. And so, there's the place to really begin. Learn to speak the way God wants you to speak. And develop delightful channels of communication with the one that God gave to us to be our best friend, the one that sticks closer than a brother. It's a great privilege to have a wife or to have a husband. And it's a great privilege to have them as your best friend and to be able to communicate with delight. Okay, now we have a little bit of time. Does anyone have anything they would like to say or to add? Question they want to ask? Comment they want to make? Confession? Whatever. We'll just open it up here for a little bit. Okay, for tomorrow, we're going to look at what kind of philosophy you should have as a parent. What does godly parenthood look like?